Sunday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast, in which an exciting weekend of basketball was not quite as exciting as we hoped it would be, other than Raptors-Pacers Game 7, which took us in a time machine back to the late 1990s. So we're going to talk about that game to lead off, a little bit about Frank Vogel, who was revealed today does not have a contract for next year. Then Miami-Charlotte, followed by Golden State and Portland, and then, of course, the shellacking in San Antonio Spurs Thunder. Joining me for all of that is Danny LaRue.
Excited to be here and excited to go through with some detail the horrendous ending of that Toronto-Indiana game.
Yeah, it was horrendous in some ways, not horrendous in others, because I thought the effort level on both sides was extremely high. Sure. But yeah, it was not the prettiest offensive basketball that you'll see. Maybe not the most awesomely coached end of a game that you'll ever see either. It was an 89-84 victory for Toronto. They led by 16, 83-67, with about 7 minutes left, and it seemed like the coronation was on, and then these sphincters, which felt like they were going to loosen, began to tighten again in the Air Canada Center considerably.
Yeah, it doesn't help when your offense decides to play the equivalent of the basketball equivalent of a prevent defense and just not do anything for half of your possessions.
Yeah, it was pretty remarkable that the extent to which Toronto was just began bleeding time, I guess, once they thought that the game's over. Although, you could say that they did make the Pacers run out of time, right? Like, at the end, if they go earlier and it scored just as badly, maybe the Pacers actually complete the comeback. So there is something to be said for the fact that you're wasting, for sure, another 5 to 7 seconds on each possession. But that said, I think they could have done a lot better to score. In the aggregate, though, what this game was really about, you know, we talked about DeMar DeRozan, that he put up 32 shots, a Raptors franchise playoff record, ultimately ended up being pretty inefficient. You know, we talked about some of the calls down the end as well. The Pacers, you know, didn't get the greatest whistle in this one. But the biggest thing was actually possessions. The Pacers had 13 turnovers and the Raptors only had 8, which helps. That's actually never passing it kind of helps you to not turn it over. And running the clock down like that helps you to not turn it over. And then the Pacers had 5 offensive rebounds and Toronto had 18. And that was really the game where the Pacers actually outshot Toronto significantly.
Yeah, actually, the Pacers and Raptors made the same number of shots, 34, and the Pacers only made one more 3. So you have that, but Toronto attempted 16 more shots from the field and 9 more free throws.
Yeah, that's really, you nailed it exactly there. And Indiana also shot 9 out of 19 from 3, and Toronto was 8 out of 24. But, you know, it didn't matter because Toronto got so many more shot attempts. So that was really a key. Valanciunas had 6 offensive rebounds, although he did have his customary few that were just repeated ineffectual tips. And then Biombo had 4. Kyle Lowry had 2. Carroll had 2. Patrick Patterson had 2. So they really were able to, especially when the Pacers, you would think of as kind of the better rebounding team in this one, just were not able to get it done. And especially in the first half is when they really got on the offensive glass. I think they had 11 offensive rebounds in the first half.
And one of the other major takeaways for me from this game is that we saw Toronto basically as close as they'll probably get to their final form in terms of rotation and minute distribution. Joseph, 26, Norman Powell, 23, Biombo, 19, and then Terrence Ross, just 5. Like, while you don't want to play Lowry and DeRozan, you know, high 30s every game in the playoffs, it's not that far off. And if they can get 22 from Patterson, I'd love to see him shift up into, like, the 26 range. But that's so much closer than they were at the start of this series when Scola was getting 14, Terrence Ross was getting 18. You know, they've changed it around, and I think that was part of what made the difference in this game.
Norman Powell was unbelievable. 5 out of 6 from the field, 3 of 4 on threes for his 13 points. Also played pretty good defense, always fantastic in the effort categories as well. And Powell, which I'd forgotten, they actually got him in the Grievous Vasquez trade. Not only did they get a first-round pick out of the Bucks for Grievous Vasquez, but they also got the pick that became Norman Powell. That is incredible. I think it was the 46th pick, which, you know, is not an amazing pick. That's a pick that you can usually buy for $400,000 or so, maybe. But in this case, it was a great selection, and he's been fantastic.
And it is also the benefit, especially in the second round where you're not expecting a lot and you get a guy for 3 years at, you know, near the minimum, to get somebody who's 22, he'll turn 23 later this month. You know, that is somewhat of a downside. And, you know, when you're taking somebody in the first round that they're that much older, was some discussion on Twitter today about that with Frank Kaminsky. But when you get a guy in the second round, especially when he's going to be an effort guy and the kind of the part of you in that part of your rotation, not a problem at all.
So another thing that I thought was very important in this one is that the Pacers' two big lineup really got smashed at the start of each half. And we'd been talking about that a lot in game six, that was where they would have the advantage with Turner guarding Patrick Patterson. And especially in the third quarter, Patterson finally was able to get and knock down some open threes at Turner's expense. And he ended up 3 of 5 from the 3-point line, hitting 3 of their 8 3-pointers. And whether it was just plays where Turner, just due to his big man instincts, overhelped. I think there was only one of them was a pick and pop. I still think they should have gone to that even more. But, and that forced them to come back with Solomon Hill, who actually was +6 on the night in a game that they lost by 5. Miles Turner was -12. And much of that compiled during that two big period. And the Pacers also struggled a little bit for spacing as well. Turner was rushing his jump shot. He was only 2 out of 11, although he did have 4 blocks. He's just been fantastic blocking shots in this series. So it was good to see Toronto able to take advantage of that. But the problem for Vogel is, even if you're going to play Solomon Hill a lot, you don't really have any other small ball four options. Maybe you could have just gone with George at the four and played CJ Miles more. He only played 5 minutes. Or Stuckey, who actually was good in this game, had 9 points and shot efficiently. So maybe that's what he could have done and just had maybe just started Hill and just played the two bigs solely at center. But, you know, that lineup had been okay. I think that there was reason to believe that it wasn't going to work, though, and maybe he could have had a slightly quicker hook there.
Yeah, I think quicker hook is probably the right word, because the problem for the Pacers is that they have two guys who are natural centers who both deserve to play more minutes than if you split it in any way. If all they had together was 48 minutes, it wouldn't be enough. So that is one way to do it. I wouldn't agree that it might not be the perfect way to do it. And Toronto did do a better job of taking advantage of it. The joke I had on Twitter a couple days ago that Dwayne Casey listened to the podcast, it is kind of satisfying to see them do a lot of what we've been harping on for 4 games in the last couple. And overwhelmingly it worked. We're not always right, but it was nice to be right here.
Early on in this game, a couple of quick thoughts. Vogel had the chance to go conservative with Paul George's foul trouble. He got 2 right down the end of the first quarter, took him out for about a minute. And previously in the series with both George Hill and with PG, he had taken them out early in the first and then not brought them back to start the second quarter. He did not do that here. He just decided to go for it. And, you know, they also finally played George Hill 40 minutes as well. And you wonder maybe if a couple of those games, game 5 would have been the one where if you'd played George Hill just a little bit more, then perhaps they could have pulled that one out as well after they blew the lead. Lawson only ended up playing 5 minutes in this one. And they used Monte more at backup point guard as well. But Vogel did well on that score, another kind of adjustment that was made. Casey went away from Terrence Ross completely, finally, in the second half and played Powell like we talked about. He played him a little bit in the first half. And then we should also talk about that awesome 360 dunk that Paul George had, maybe like one of the best fast break dunks ever in playoff competition.
Yeah, when you consider the stakes, especially considering it wasn't, you know, the easiest dunk to make, it was really impressive, and I'm sure it was jarring for the home crowd just to see a guy.
They started booing him. It was great. I loved it. It was an excellent heel turn by Paul George. The third quarter also, we talked about that already with the two bigs, but Indiana's transition defense also was really bad. Part of that was because they felt like they were getting fouled and they didn't get the calls, and then they weren't really getting back very hard. You know, so that led to Toronto really going on a run early in that third quarter, which hurt a lot. And then a couple more thoughts too. DeRozan, I mean, what did you think of his game overall?
I mean, it's challenging when a guy, you know, kind of does put up numbers, but does it in a way that is inefficient. You noted early on in the game, and I agreed with you and chuckled a little bit, that him doing so well early was both a blessing and a curse. But at the same time, it wasn't like everybody else was chomping at the bit to really take those shots away from him. And, you know, he did generate a couple of free throws, but yeah, it was a DeRozan game, for better or for worse. His defense seemed a little bit better, though.
I don't know about that. But it was only better because they were hiding him on Solomon Hill the entire game, I felt like. maybe we could say it was less bad. Maybe I guess that's the same thing. It's better.
It is.
In some ways.
Coucher.
So DeRozan in his 40 minutes, 10 out of 32 from the field, took another 9 free throws. So that meant that he had 30 points on 36 shooting possessions. Not efficient at all. And even when this is the thing, I've talked about this a lot with these kind of mid-range artists. And DeRozan is better than some of them because he at least will get to the foul line, at least in his best incarnation. But when you're one of these mid-range guys, even during the periods when you're kind of heating up, like the best you're going to do is shoot maybe like a little over 50%. Like in the first quarter, whenever it's like, oh man, he's really killing it, he ended up 5 for 11 for 13 points, which is like basically average NBA efficiency right there, maybe a little bit. And those were the good days. You know, those were the solid days. And at one point, he was 10 out of 24 and then proceeded to miss his last 8 shots of the game as they really started to lock down. And really he was getting a lot of commentary down the end of the third quarter where it didn't come back to hurt him because Indiana couldn't score either, but he was taking every single shot, and every single shot was a bad shot. Like one time he had like Valanciunas came out to set a pick and roll on him, and DeRozan had George Hill, who's a little bit shorter, but still an excellent defensive player. And he waved Valanciunas away, went to the ISO, and then shot, you know, a 19-foot fadeaway. That was a really, really, you know, a 35% shot. And you're like, you're really going to wave the pick and roll away to take that kind of shot? It was really a little bit galling, but we'll see if he can be more efficient in the next round against at least Miami starters that don't have a great answer for him.
They don't have a great answer, but they can put size on him depending on what lineups Toronto throws out there.
So a couple more thoughts here before we break down the end of it. Biombo just has impressed me so much with his defensive rebounding. When he goes up to get the defensive rebound, it's just no one else is getting it. Like if he's in the area, he just absolutely skies for it. You know, certainly an offensive liability, but a guy who I think can be very valuable to especially teams like a Portland or something that, you know, really struggles to, maybe not Portland because then you could just trap the pick and roll and he wouldn't be able to do anything. But teams that, like Chicago is another one, obviously, that really need a defensive center. His old employers in Charlotte would even be potentially another one as like a bench center who maybe can close games and you really need to protect the rim. I think he could be pretty effective that way.
I like him more as a piece of the rotation, the center rotation, than the centerpiece of the rotation, but he's going to get a lot of money anyway, and I'm thrilled for him that he will.
So it was 83-67 with 7:26 left, and the Raptors then scored 6 points the rest of the way. I think they had 2 Lowry layups, which were both great drives over Mahinmi very late in the clock, and then the DeMar DeRozan free throws at the end, I think, were the only points that they scored during that period. The DeRozan free throws were the result of being fouled. And, you know, it wasn't like Indiana was absolutely killing it either. I mean, I thought one of the key plays during this stretch was the Paul George offensive foul after getting the steal. Did you think that that was a good call?
I did. I didn't get that really, you know, super clear look at it, but to me it seemed like the right call. He used it to push off. DeRozan did exaggerate the contact a little bit, but he did push off, and he didn't need to, which was the most egregious part of it. If he had just stopped, he would have been fine.
Yeah, and it's tough in that situation because when you bump into someone, your natural instinct is to just use your forearm to protect yourself so the guy doesn't, like, hit you right in the ribs. But for George, he did kind of extend it a little bit, and it was really kind of, he had made a great play to get the steal. It was good hustle to get back from DeRozan, but it was a tired foul. You know, when you get tired, rather than really moving your body, exploding, you kind of start to push and you start to lean on guys. And that was sort of that play. I mean, you know, George played 46 minutes. You know, you can't say that he, you know, wasn't in good enough shape or something, but it's just an unavoidable consequence, those kind of plays sometimes, of being tired.
I agree completely. It was one of those circumstances. And there was another, I'm trying to remember what it was. I think it was in like the second quarter when he'd been in for a while and he just kind of didn't really get around the play and reached in and got a foul. But that's going to happen. And he only had 4 for the game, even though he started with those 2 early. So you can't knock the hustle in that way.
So for Toronto, we noted that they went to what Bill Simmons affectionately calls the clogged toilet offense, and that you got to start that off, obviously, with walking the ball up the floor in Kyle Lowry's hands and nearly getting an 8-second violation on every possession. Like, that's clearly the way that you have to start there.
And the most incredible of those was when there was a shot clock violation, so you're not even starting with it on the baseline. You have it up there, and you still almost get an eight-second violation.
And, you know, the couple times that they went fast, like, they went fast once when they were up 8, 85-77 out of a timeout, and they actually went quick. And, hey, they got a great shot at Damari Carroll floater off a cut that just, you know, they weren't able to make. And Valanciunas had a bunch of tip attempts at the offensive rebound, too. You know, if he'd gotten a couple of those to go down, you know, we might not necessarily be having this conversation. But it really just, there were plays where, you know, they didn't do anything until 6 on the shot clock where Kyle Lowry went to screen for DeMar DeRozan. There was another time where Lowry was just dribbling around at half court and didn't just call for the simple screen from Valanciunas until there were 6 seconds left on the shot clock. That was actually the one where he scored the lefty layup over Mahimi. But it was still just so, so ugly. So many times they would try to drive, and you know, it was a case where they clearly ran out of time as a result of that, right? They, you know, Lowry would drive, kick it to DeRozan, he didn't have anything. DeRozan had a play where he tried to a spin move, didn't have anything, threw it to Carroll, and then they got a shot clock violation. It was just remarkable how slow they were going, and you know, the teams that are really good offenses just don't do that. And while the Raptors can move the ball a little bit more at times, when something you always revert back to what's in your DNA, I think, at the end of the game, and that's what they're most comfortable doing is, you know, make the palms down gesture. Okay, calm down, guys, which means just stand there for 10 seconds, and then we'll panic because we don't have enough time left.
You never want to mistake activity for achievement, but early activity provides a value all the same, because if you're actually moving and trying to do something, if it doesn't work, then you just keep holding the ball, and if you get something clean, then you take that look, and you have to trust your own offense that when you get a look worth taking, that you actually can pull the trigger on it. And then the worst case scenario, if you move earlier, is that you get exactly what they got into with 6 seconds left. So it's infuriating to me to see a team not even try. Even if you just try things and you are super picky, you're at least begging the chance for a mistake. There's actually a parallel to this. I don't know if we'll bring it up with the Warriors. There was a moment in, I think it was the second quarter in particular, maybe in the third as well, where they didn't even try. Like, they were settling too much. And the idea for me is if you make a defense work for even 18 seconds, it's a lot more likely that they're going to make a mistake than if you give them 12 or 10.
And you're just putting so much pressure on a guy, too, that because your first move has to work or you have nothing. You know, it makes perfect sense that you would want 4 or 5 bites the apple on a given possession rather than 1 or 0, as it even was on some of those. During this stretch, though, at the end, I think we rag on Monte Ellis a lot. I thought he was actually pretty darn good tonight, and he had 7 assists through some really nice passes. Not his forte, but he was even trying to pressure up, and you could tell it was totally exhausting him by the end of the fourth quarter. But to his credit, like he kept on trucking. He hit a nice layup in transition to bring him within 8. He hit a ridiculous late clock 3 to really tighten things up, get the Pacers within 3. That was when Lowry was able to get that layup with 2:14 left. And then the next play looked like live, that it was definitely a foul, where Ellis drove in from the left wing and looked like he just lost it just about out of bounds. And he was just totally irate afterwards, hoping for a call. But I slowed it down to like super slow-mo, and I couldn't really tell exactly what happened, whether there was a foul or not. I don't think we ever saw a replay of that one, and the ball was kind of behind him. But it looked, I mean, if I had to guess, it looked like he kind of just lost it out. But for him to be that angry, you'd think there was some contact. I just couldn't see where it was on the replay.
Yeah, Monte, from my experiences with him, he's not somebody who gets that aggrieved unless there's something. You know, it might not be enough. There's a line between something and enough. But that would seem to me like he felt that there was something there. And considering the way that the whistle went against the Pacers late, it wouldn't be that surprising.
So the next time down, Toronto took a timeout with 13 on the shot clock, and then they inbounded it, really had nothing going at all. Corey Joseph drove and then had nothing. Lowry had to miss a really bad fadeaway that actually almost went down. And then they were coming down on the fast break. The Pacers, this was just the key turnover. Paul George, this is another, I think, kind of tired play where he just, you know, he was kind of 1-on-4, but he had a little bit of an advantage with guys on their heels. And just lost it out of bounds, which was just, you know, an absolute killer down 5 with 1:24 left in the game.
Yeah, it was tough, and you know that in conjunction with the DeRozan play that we discussed earlier, it struck me later on, I thought it a little bit at the time, but as I was kind of thinking about the way that the game ended, that the Pacers came a lot closer to winning this game than I thought at the time.
So next time there was that foul by George Hill where he just smacked Lowry in the face. They were lucky that they weren't in the bonus at that time, but it did bleed off some more time. And then the Raptors, of course, with only 14 on the shot clock after the foul, they didn't even try to start a play with 6 seconds left on the clock. That was the play where Lowry tried to screen for DeRozan. And Valanciunas got a couple of tips that could have, gone in, but didn't. And then George, coming down in transition, Solomon Hill did a great step-up screen in transition out near midcourt. That put George one-on-one against DeRozan, who, obviously it was overmatched and ended up fouling. It was DeRozan, the other incredibly bad defense he had in this game was that Solomon Hill dunk in transition. Like, nobody noticed it because the dunk was so awesome, but he actually made DeRozan fall down with his dribble move, and then he dunked it all over Lowry. That was just an awesome play. Solomon Hill, rookie option was declined, by the way, in case we never mentioned that before.
Well-known dynamic ball handler Solomon Hill shook DeMar DeRozan. And that dunk was awesome. I mean, to me, that was the in-game dunk of this contest.
Solomon Hill actually has more ball skills than I think people realize. Sure. And he had another pretty nice Euro step in this one for a bucket, and then another one where he ended up getting a shot block from behind, but it was still a pretty good move. And he kind of played more of like a mini Draymond Green role in college, has done that kind of defensively for the Pacers, but has not really had the ball in his hands at all. And I think a more creative coach could find a way to use him, especially, in like a 4-1 pick and roll type of play, similar ways to how they use it. Draymond, I mean, he's not as strong as Draymond. He's not as good in the post, probably not as good a 3-point shooter either. Obviously not the same defender, although he still can guard 1 through 4 pretty well. And they put him on DeRozan a lot of this game when George was in foul trouble too. But anyway, enough on Solomon Hill. We've probably been overstating our love for him just because the Pacers so understated it by declining his rookie option. So George hit 2 free throws. I think he made like his last like 30 free throws of the series, by the way.
Yeah. God. So do you want to get into the last real offensive possession for Toronto now?
Yeah, that was, another slow developing play. They ran a 1-2 pick and roll with Joseph guarded by Ellis screening for Lowry. And Lowry had an advantage on George Hill. Indiana did a great job of not switching those plays all series, keeping Hill on Lowry, keeping George on DeRozan when he was the one being screened. And they correctly realized, and I think a lot of teams don't do that great a job of this, that those are kind of dummy actions. And if you actually really practice to defend those plays without switching, really, are we worried about Corey Joseph as the role man? No, we're not going to switch that. We'll just help and recover. But Lowry did have an advantage, but he slowed it down, did not take it with about maybe 10 on the shot clock. And then he was forced to throw a flaming bad to DeRozan, who missed. And there was a fight for the rebound. 3 Raptors were on the ground. Solomon Hill gets the rebound, throws it to George Hill, and Frank Vogel calls timeout with 3 Raptors on the ground, down by 3 with 26 seconds left.
And this all gets back to an idea that has been around since the starting of the Dunked On Basketball podcast, which is when you're in a situation where you're down 3, what is your best chance to tie and ideally win the game? And we talk a lot about the idea of the perils of a quick 2 because it just lowers your chances, especially assuming the other team is a competent inbounding team. But calling a timeout when you have a fast break is along the same lines, where that is probably going to be your best chance. And taking away your best chance, especially when you're not going to make a prominent, like, essential offensive substitution, is taking away by far your cleanest opportunity at what would give you the best chance of tying the game.
Now, let's not go too crazy here. I think Seth's research has shown that when you have a chance to tie with a 3, you're going to hit that, 25% of the time or so when the other team knows that you have to get a 3. But quick 2s don't really go down that much either, and then you still are not guaranteed that you're going to be in any better of a position after they hit 2 free throws. This is a great free throw shooting team. The other thing, too, about the timeout, number one, you're probably going to get a much better chance at a 3 in transition on a play like that, or a quick 2, for that matter. And I tweeted at the time, like, did he call this timeout to make sure they could set up the quick 2? Like that, and that's exactly what they did. So he called timeout to almost ensure that they were going to get a worse shot than they probably would have had otherwise. And he also allowed them to get defensive subs onto the floor as well. Like, they were, Valanciunas was in. If they don't call timeout, you could just run a pick and roll at Valanciunas and almost certainly get a three-pointer if you want it. You might have to be a little bit further out than normal, or you just blow right by him and then you get your quick two if you want, because he's not going to be able to defend that far out on the floor if he's in like a no threes posture. But they got Biombo in instead. He provided crucial help on the eventual George drive. And then, of course, you know, they did get screwed by that call, right? Like, I mean, DeRozan, who, by the way, also probably shouldn't have been in the game. I don't know why they wouldn't have just put Powell in instead of DeRozan as a defensive sub there. But DeRozan basically took out Mahinmi's legs as George threw the alley-oop to him. And I also don't know why Vogel wouldn't have gone with a more offensive-oriented lineup, either one of his more smalls or go with Turner instead of Mahinmi. Turner is definitely the superior offensive player to Mahinmi, although Mahinmi was good down the end. So it was really a lot of interesting kind of things that could have been better. We don't know what those would have added up to. Obviously, the Pacers were outplayed in this one to begin with, and down three with 26 seconds left is not the greatest win percentage anyway, but they did not maximize their chances, I don't think.
Yeah, they did a reasonable job, of course, facilitated by Toronto, of getting back into a game they should have never been back in the first place. And so we can talk about this stuff, but at the same point, this was always a low win expectancy situation for them once it got to like probably the start of the fourth quarter.
So before, I mean, that pretty much ended it then. You know, they were so mad about the Mahinmi foul that everyone kind of, or non-foul, that they didn't foul early. But, you know, DeRozan hit both free throws to put them up five anyway. Like, the game was over. The not fouling didn't really hurt them that bad, although it was a little bit of a mental breakdown there, especially because one of the whole point of calling timeout, too, is, hey, make sure we foul, you know, if we don't score, or even if we do, or we should have been trapping or whatever. I mean, everyone ran back like they thought they were just going to be playing defense, except for George, and even took him 5 seconds to calm down that there wasn't a call and realize he had to run after DeRozan. But I think we should take a second here to pay homage to Paul George, who probably was the best player in the playoffs in the first round.
He was spectacular. And usually when a player has to take on the kind of defensive burden that Paul George did, you see their offense suffer. And his offense absolutely did not suffer in this series. I thought he really did thrive and showed that he can be the best player against a talented team in a series that matters.
Yeah, and Toronto doesn't have the best wing options, but, you know, Carroll, especially as he got healthier, he's still not totally healthy. Like, there was one post-up he had in this game where he just, you know, was posting up against, like, Monte or something and just, like, didn't have the strength to back him down. You know, he definitely is, you know, still not quite there physically, but he got to where he was able to at least defend George. Norman Powell was okay. Obviously, DeRozan guarding him in the first game was kind of not the optimal matchup for the Raptors. But nonetheless, yeah, he was fantastic. He also had basically probably playing more minutes than anyone else in the playoffs, too. You know, just has more pressure on him maybe than anyone outside of James Harden to create offense for his team among these playoff teams. I mean, who else would you even consider for that category of, like, the best player in the playoffs? I mean, maybe Klay would probably be, like, the number two guy right now.
Klay, Draymond. I mean, Kawhi has done well in limited minutes. That's always a weird thing with that.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing he could have done against Memphis that would have made me the OKC and San Antonio are kind of burned by the fact that they didn't play anyone in the first round. So they're sort of, those guys are sort of eliminated from consideration. And for Golden State, it's only because Steph was out that you kind of look at it a little bit more. Yeah, I would say Klay, Draymond, and Paul George would be like my top three playoff MVP ballot of the first round. And yeah, then who do you like, Wade or something maybe? I mean, he did basically win that game six by himself.
Yeah, he was big. I think even though they lost game five, he was big at the end of that game as well. Did they lose game five? Yeah, they did, right?
I think did the Cavs play? That was so long ago. They're playing on Monday. We actually probably need to talk about that series a little bit in a preview and do a prediction.
Yeah, we will.
Yeah, let's make a note on that. So yeah, Paul George was outstanding. But the bigger news that came out right after the game, very interesting timing on this one, was the Woj bomb. I think nobody knew this, that Frank Vogel was in fact in the last year of his contract this entire year, and there have been no discussions on an extension. So that would mean, it would seem like, the odds are that he's not going to return. And then Greg Doyle from the Indy Star asked Larry Bird whether Vogel was going to be back next year, and Bird said, come on, man, the game just ended, and then he walked off.
It's crazy because we've already seen so much of the market settle and resolve. I mean, Luke Walton already took the job with the Lakers, and he was only available for a day and a half. And Vogel is among the most interesting coaches that is on the market. And so if he is truly available, then I don't think that anybody necessarily, unless he really wanted to go to Brooklyn for some reason, really missed out on him in that way, because I think I would have had Tibbs above him anyway. But it does really affect that, and who knows what he wants.
What do you think of him as a coach?
One of the most important things that a coach can do is do well on defense. And early on, you know, in those years with David West and Roy Hibbert and, of course, young Paul George, I gave a lot of credit to the personnel. They had these guys that were going to do it. This year, they had a lot of turnover. They did end up playing bigs more often. And they were, I believe, third in the league in defensive efficiency. So he's not, you know, he's not going to be a game changer. I don't think he's one of the five best coaches in the league. But if you can get guys to play defense, you're so valuable in this league. And I think we saw that with Skiles in Orlando. And I think Vogel's a better coach than Skiles.
From basically the moment that Vogel took over, I want to say it was Jim O'Brien that he replaced in the 2010-11 season. The Pacers have defended, and they were much better that year. Then as Paul George really came into his own, as Hibbert became, you know, a great rim protector, they were excellent on defense. And then even last year, when Paul George missed nearly the entire season, they again were great. He's developed Jan Mahimi into a great defensive player. George Hill was already there, but they've used his talents as well. And yeah, they're just like, I think Vogel, depending on the talent, I think he's almost a guarantee to improve your defense if you're just, you know, if you're a team that's bad enough to fire your coach. Offensively, I think things leave a little bit to be desired. I think that a lot of his teams, to some extent, have underachieved based on some of the talent that they have had. I think that they are not, there are none of his teams that you would say really move the ball well. There are none of his teams that you would say set great screens, really execute incredibly well. And, you know, I'm not saying that they really underperformed, but he's not a guy that you look at. And then I think part of the reason why there have not been contract extension discussions is this desire from the organization to play smaller and play faster. And Vogel acceded to that early on this year, and he went away from it because they really weren't defending very well, and CJ Miles just wasn't really that good. And then they were going with the two bigs for a while. They got their defense back. You know, they were third in defense, but you still get the impression that that's not how Larry Bird wanted to play, and that Vogel went with ultimately what he felt was comfortable, he was comfortable with, and maybe that's just not what the organization wants. Now, the irony is that you could absolutely play small with Solomon Hill at the four, and the organization, you know, declined his option. Like, he would be one of the perfect players in theory to play that way. But, you know, also, even when Hill is out there in this series, which was most of the time, it's not like their offense was like really lighting things up either and moving the ball and, you know, being huge threats. You know, they shoot well from 3-point range. They just don't generate enough of those attempts. So I understand maybe where the organization is coming from and that this is somewhat of a staid offensive system, but I think the chances are that whoever they get could be an upgrade on Vogel are pretty low when you consider how good he's been defensively. And then also, this is a team that's got $30 million in cap room. You know, how is a new coach going to affect what they're going to end up doing with that? You know, I think also, if I had to guess, that Monte is probably not really a Frank Vogel kind of player. So I don't know. Maybe Vogel wants to go elsewhere, but it seems like if there haven't been any extension talks at all at this point, that the organization doesn't value him as much or just thinks maybe there's time for a change. And we've seen, you know, sometimes those work and sometimes they don't.
While you were talking, I thought of a team. I had mentioned that nobody really missed out on him, and I don't think they would have spent this money for Vogel, but he would have been awesome with the Suns. You know, I think to really try to build their defense, they have a perimeter defender, a point guard in Eric Bledsoe that I think he could have worked wonders with.
Well, there's one problem why he wouldn't be awesome for the Suns, and that's that, you know, he clearly would probably ask for Scott Brooks money. And
yeah, exactly. That they wouldn't have hired him. And
but I'll tell you where I do think he might be a fit is in Houston.
Sure.
If they're talking about Jeff Van Gundy, if they're, you know, the fact that they have Harden who can kind of ISO anyway, and they've still had an efficient offense over these years, Vogel is a guy who's going to hold people accountable defensively. And so that he might be, if they're talking about Jeff Van Gundy and they are talking about Tibbs, Vogel is kind of right from that same sort of a school of having strengths as a coach.
And that opens the door for Clint Capela to grow defensively. Vogel has done a really nice job making defensive bigs better, which is the other reason why, another one that will not happen. But I would love to see what he could do for Kristaps Porzingis defensively. Like, if somebody could really make that change and build him into at least a stable defender, Vogel would be as good a try as anybody who's out there.
All right, that's probably enough Pacers talk, but that Vogel news was like quite the bombshell, and I wanted to talk about it a little bit. Before we move on to Miami and Charlotte, let's talk to you about our friends at Indochino. Indochino makes custom made-to-measure suits and has made them affordable, really, for the first time for everyone. I always wanted one. I'm kind of, an oddly shaped guy, and I couldn't afford it. It was thousands of dollars. If I went to a department store, I go to try to get something off the rack, and they tailor it, and they say it's going to fit you perfectly, but it really doesn't. And so instead, I now am getting my suits from Indochino. They take 14 measurements, and you send them in. There's instructions on the website. And then 3 to 4 weeks later, you get your suit. You can customize your lapel size. You can customize the side pockets. You can customize the liner. You can customize a monogram. It's really a remarkably powerful site. And if you don't like your suit, you can send it back, and they will retailer it for you. Or if that doesn't work, then you can get it for free. So there's no risk. You can get an awesome suit that fits you perfectly. It will be your best fitting suit that you own. And right now, my listeners can get that for $399 using the CapSpace code. Very easy to remember because we talk about that all the time in the program. So it's Indochino.com with the CapSpace code, your look, your way. Really kind of a crappy end to a great series in the Charlotte-Miami one. Charlotte just was a shell of themselves by the end. Lynn was injured. Cody Zeller could barely move. Batum was a shell of himself. Jeremy Lin was never the same after spraining his ankle in Game 5, and they just ran out of firepower.
Yeah, it was, in a weird way, it was kind of an admirable exit in the sense that it made you appreciate just how worn down that Hornets team was, and their luck was terrible in that sense. But I don't know, I gained an appreciation for it, and at the same time, I couldn't stop myself from thinking about the off season that they have, because over half their team is free agents, so you never really know where that's going to go. But they fought valiantly. They had a lot of their guys who were hurt played anyway, and risked. Jeremy Lin's a free agent, probably. Batum is a free agent. And so to see those guys go all out for a win that definitely wasn't there by the end of it was impressive in a way.
So the reason that Miami won this game was they just destroyed Charlotte in the paint and on the boards. Hassan Whiteside was absolutely dominant. The Hornets shot 6 out of 24 in the restricted area. I can't remember another time in which a team has shot that poorly of percentage in the restricted area over that many shots. And they're a further 5 out of 14 in the lane. And they couldn't get it going from anywhere, really. They're 9 of 25 from mid-range, too. So it was ugly all around. They only put up 73 points. The game was over by the end of the third quarter. But really, Whiteside, we kind of, in the middle part of the series, he was not playing well. But he was dominant in games 1 and 2, other than when he was in Blancoat foul trouble territory. And I think that hip might have been bothering him, and he really got into it in this one, and I thought he was by far the biggest difference for Miami in this one.
Yeah, he was fantastic. He had a nice real stretch as a pick-and-roll finisher. He was affecting shots at the rim and blocking shots, which are two different things but are related. And you could see his imprint out there, and the people who have argued for him as a max player got a real strong arrow in their quiver in this game.
5 offensive rebounds, 5 blocks for Whiteside. Charlotte just got murdered on the offensive glass in the first half. Miami just had more bodies, more athletes, played with more force. It didn't help that Charlotte started Kaminsky and Jefferson again and stuck with them way too long. Zeller just could not get off the bench. In fact, Zeller was even in this one through three quarters, and Al Jefferson was negative 21 in that same amount of time, basically. So Zeller couldn't move at all, but I mean, he could move enough to play. So I felt like, and Jefferson just was so bad defensively. He alternated between letting Whiteside get offensive rebounds over him and then staying glued to Whiteside when guys would just drive right down the lane and he was just totally unable to contest. And one of the people that he was repeatedly unable to contest was Goran Dragic, who had by far his best game of the series with 25 points.
Yeah, he was huge. 25 points, 11 of 17 from the field, a couple of beautiful finishes, including my favorite one was where they actually ended up using the footage because I think it was set up by a nice defensive play where he did a spin move and finished, of course, lefty. And I just thought he looked physically and mentally, he looked as engaged as I've seen him in a long time, which is huge when they're now going into a series facing Kyle Lowry and the Toronto Raptors.
Yeah, Ethan Skolnick pointed out something that I thought was huge and that people don't talk about that much, is that Dwayne Wade's activity is a big barometer for the Heat as well. When he is hitting the glass, when he is he never guards the best guy on the other team, but when he still is like making an effort all over the place the way he was back in those early days of the big three, and he can summon that athleticism still at times. You know, he is a guy who was one of the best athletes in NBA history at the two guard position, and he still has enough left on occasion to bring it, and he did in this game. That was huge. There really not much more to say about this one. I mean, I'm glad that Miami is moving on just because I think they're going to give us a much better series in the next round. I think Charlotte just was out of gas physically, and not even from a shape standpoint as much as an injury standpoint. One other thing on Charlotte, though, before we talk about the next series, is Nicola Batum had a tweet saying basically that we really need to improve and, you know, thank you so much, Charlotte. Not the type of tone that a guy who does not expect to be back would be taking as a free agent. And Charlotte can offer him another year and higher raises, you know, and for a guy who's 27, probably if he's a free agent again at the end of 4 years instead of five, he's not going to get, you know, basically $30 million a year, which is for that last year at age 32 or whatever he'll be. So that fifth year, if Charlotte does decide to go there, does decide to totally max him out, we'll probably keep him in town. That probably turns into a bad contract by the end of it. But as a team that's not a big market and kind of needs to fulfill, have some sustained success, you know, maybe that's not the end of the world with where the cap is going to pay him that.
Well, there are going to be a ton of teams with cap space this summer. There are not a ton that have clear-cut better circumstances, unless he has priorities that are different than I'm initially anticipating. Like you could make an argument that Boston would be a better team theoretically. You know, they could have the space to do it just because. And then he has Jay Crowder, so then defensively it's a little bit easier for him because he can guard the less effective guy. But that's not just such a dramatic change that you're sitting there going, oh, I have to leave here so I can be a part of something special. The Warriors aren't going to really have that space for him in that sense. And there are, you know, if he wants to live in a big city, he could do that. But Charlotte has a nice core together. They also will be getting Michael Kidd-Gilchrist back, who is a wonderful player when he's healthy. They had that really nice, like, four-game stretch when he and Batum could play together. And even though there is uncertainty around them, if you had Kemba, Batum, MKG, Lamb, and Cody Zeller, and all of the other kind of depth pieces they have, even if they lose out on some of their free agents, that's still a pretty good team.
This team, if they could get a center who could play pick and roll and protect the rim a little bit, and now I don't know if they can fit all these guys in money-wise, if they could then bring back Marvin, bring back Batum, and then your fours are just going to be MKG and Marvin Williams, and that's it. And then you maybe bring back Al Jefferson as your center off the bench just to score on the second unit, hopefully for cheap. And then you get that center who can protect the rim and maybe play pick and roll a little bit. You know, that might be too expensive, and I haven't really gone through to see who that would be. But if they had all of that, then they probably won't be able to afford Lin under that scenario because they won't be able to pay him to go over the cap really to pay him very much. But because he's only on the first year of his deal, he's only making like $2 million. But I think that they could be a really, really good team if they committed to playing that way. And then, you know, you could also work in MKG and Marvin playing together as well. Marvin actually apparently had some elbow injury, and maybe that explains why his shooting vacillated so much in this series. But I think you could have a very solid foundation of a low 50 win team with that, with Kemba coming back. Maybe he'll take another step forward. Clifford as the coach, I'd love to see what he can do defensively with a team that actually has like a real center in there too. You know, bring back Zeller as well. He could play some center too, maybe a little power forward. I think that could be a pretty damn good team.
And they also, well, of course, this is way too far in the future. If the MKG-Batum combo, I think, works very well against Cleveland, especially as LeBron gets a little bit older. I think you just sick MKG on him for as much as you can, and he'll do a reasonably good job. And if you can have a rim protector at center. So I think you can make an argument that depending on if they can build out, like you were saying, that they're the type of team that could give them trouble. That doesn't mean they'd win, but they would be well suited. And as long as it looks like we're not going to a top 16 anytime soon, you do have to think about that a little bit when you're a near term team, which with their current age curve, that's what you have to think of it as.
Yeah. The last thing on them is that you do have to be a little wary of the fact that Marvin and Batum both had big years where, you know, that were way beyond what they had done before, even Kemba as well. And now if you're going to pay Batum and pay Marvin in this crazy cap at their market value, you know, maybe expecting them to be absolutely as good as they were this year may be unrealistic.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'll see. Let's talk about Miami and Toronto now. I think one big thing in Toronto's favor from this tough first round series that we both predicted would happen in seven. Do you not get the points from that because you changed up that, say, the Pacers were going to win today, by the way?
Nope. That's not the way it works. It's on the predictions of the time. Also, like, I firmly believe that this, I got some crap for that. And it's just like, for me, I'm fair to adjust based on the situation on the ground. Like, it's just funny to me that people, like, there are people, maybe it's our background being lawyers, it's like, for me, if I get information that changes what I think is going to happen in the series, I'm not going to say, oh, well, I said, you know, before we had all this new information, I said X, so I'm going to stick with it. That makes zero sense to me.
Yeah, my prediction was that Toronto's, the home court and Toronto's supporting players would outplay the Pacers, and that would make up for Lowry and DeRozan continuing to be bad. And I guess that's kind of what happened. So I feel good about that one. There are plenty of others I've gotten wrong so far. But I do think, getting back to my original point, that this series was very good for Toronto because it forced Dwayne Casey to actually start playing the right way. And when you're going against a team in Miami that plays, you know, only one big at a time, now you really need to start playing that way. And so things like starting Patterson, things like, you know, not playing Scola at all, Norman Powell playing more over Terrence Ross, all of those things, I think, hopefully will continue to transfer over to the next series. And I think make them a better team now than they might have been if they had rolled in this series, stuck with what they were comfortable with, but that was actually the inferior way of playing, and then ran into the steamroll in Miami and were down 2-0 before they could actually make those changes.
Game one of this series will occur on Tuesday when we're going to presumably get to Oracle early enough to watch it. How are you going to feel when they announce Luis Scola as the starting power forward for game one?
Well, I think my pick in this is going to be Toronto in seven. And I think that people are thinking, you know, psychologically, getting that burden off your back. Brent Berry had a great quote on the broadcast today where he said that the psychological burden of finishing what you have started, when it's like, oh, we had this great season and now, you know, we're almost going to throw it away by losing in the first round, like, that kind of pressure can be very difficult. I also think that DeRozan will have a better chance against people who are not named Paul George. That's going to be a very, very interesting decision for Eric Spoelstra. How much is he going to play guys like Winslow and Richardson to guard Lowry and DeRozan? Because DeRozan, their starting lineup, are you going to go now with Dang on DeRozan to start with? I don't think Dang is quite quick enough to deal with DeRozan, especially at his age. He can do an okay job, but he's not going to lock him down the way a lot of, you know, Paul George did. And then Winslow and Richardson, are those guys going to be good enough offensively, especially Winslow? I think that the battle between Richardson and Winslow versus Powell and Joseph on the second unit is going to be awesome to watch. Some really athletic guys who play really hard and like to get up and down, you know, young guys. It's good to see like those kind of matchups in the playoffs. You don't get that too much. But I think, you know, I think DeRozan can play better. I'm still worried that Lowry's elbow is just so jacked up. I mean, he's got to be shooting like 35% since like the end of March at this point now, when you include the playoffs. But he will at least get a chance to go against Dragic. Like, that Heat starting lineup is not well equipped to defend Toronto, other than having Whiteside there at the rim. So yeah, it'll be it'll be really interesting, and I think that the Raptors bench and their supporting players can just do enough, and I think they will win in seven, but I do not feel remotely great about that pick. What do you think?
I feel good about my pick, and my pick is Miami in six. I think that Hassan Whiteside will be a gigantic factor in this series. He has shown, as long as he can avoid foul trouble, and he will at least in some of these games, I think he will be an eraser at the rim, and that is such an important part of what Toronto does. You are right in terms of the defensive matchups not being nearly as favorable as Indiana. That's why I was pounding
but,
on that.
But they're not, they're, it's ugly for, I mean, is DeRozan's got to guard Johnson or Wade.
Right, that's exactly. Not, that's where I was going. And,
I guess maybe you could guard Deng.
Maybe.
Maybe they'll hide him on
or
Deng.
Or Winslow. But then you have to, then you're throwing other guys, you know, depending on what, you know, if Patterson's in there, you're not going to, you know, bounce him onto
yeah,
some of those
maybe,
guys.
I mean, I might even consider not starting Patterson, maybe bring Patterson in to match up with someone like Winslow and go with Norman Powell starting alongside Carroll. I might consider doing that, too.
That's what I would do if I were to. And the other big part of it, you brought up Kyle Lowry, who was going to be my second point after Hassan Whiteside. He doesn't look right, and yeah, he'll have an easier matchup, but they need Kyle Lowry at close to all-star form to really be the engine for this offense. I don't trust DeRozan for it. And it, one of the other huge factors in the series will be how Toronto uses Valanciunas and Biombo, because Miami only has one true center, and depending on how they handle the rest of those minutes, that was a big bugaboo in the first series. Whether they, you know, I think Valanciunas will get kind of beasted by Whiteside, and then what you're doing with Biombo is more of a nullification, and I think that that is more the tact that I would use. But it will be fascinating to see how they handle that. But on the totality, I feel much more confident that not only that Miami will, I think both teams can win on the road. I don't think that's a big deal in this. But that Miami, if it gets down to it, will pull some of those games out with defense, with shot making, than I do with Toronto as presently constituted.
This is one for not being a prisoner of the moment. That's why I'm going with this pick. Toronto was better than Miami during the regular season. Miami only had, you know, a 0.9 point differential or something. They're a better team than that overall, I think, the way they've played since acquiring Joe Johnson. But, and Toronto, with the way Lowry is playing, that's really scary for me. But I think that even so, Toronto, both having the home court, having a little bit of this burden off their back now, can play a little bit more freely. And, you know, I do think Spo has a big coaching advantage. That's a little bit of a concern as well.
And experience, but, just in yeah. on the aggregate.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, you look at the Heat rotation, like half the guys don't have much playoff experience at all. So I don't know about that.
Yeah, they have to, though.
Yeah. Yeah, so I am not at all confident in this pick, but I think just they're a better regular season team by a very substantial margin, and I don't want to be too much of a prisoner of the moment to what happened in the last series for both.
So now I get to deal with the double thing that if Toronto wins, I not only get the series I don't want, but I also get to be wrong. So that's not fun.
Yeah, I mean, I'll kind of be rooting for Miami because I just want to see them play against Cleveland. I mean, that'll be awesome. Let's do a quick Hawks-Cavs pick. Let's try and keep it quick because we still have a couple other games to talk about. I'm going to go on Cavs 5.
Yep, Cavs in 5. You, Kevin Pelton, went on Real GM Radio with me. We both agreed on Cavs in 5. It seems like everybody's going in that direction. Cleveland is just a terrible matchup for Atlanta. I think they're playing well. They did a nice job to close out that series. And, you know, Boston had some offensive struggles, but Atlanta did a nice job. But they just don't have the guys to stop LeBron and Kyrie. And I think Cleveland is playing pretty well right now. I think that
the offensive rebounding is going to be a problem. I mean, I think that's the biggest thing. They don't have anyone to stop. Like, they have this great defense, but then they can't stop LeBron in the post, and they can't get a defensive rebound. So a lot of that, I think, their specific strengths defensively are nullified a little bit. Mike Scott is going to have a big series for Atlanta. I think he's an underrated key. He was terrible last year in the playoffs. He was actually had some really nice moments against Boston, especially in that game 5 when they just absolutely killed him. So if he can get going, and Cleveland doesn't really have great options to guard him. The problem is, though, that a lot of times when he's going to be out there, they'll be going with LeBron at the 4 off the bench. So, and maybe, you know, Millsap's going to have to kill Kevin Love. That's another thing, too. We'll see if he can do that. He showed that he could score like that with that 145-point game, but wasn't really that great offensively in the other games for Atlanta. So I don't know. I think that Cleveland really hurt the Hawks last year, and while there are a lot of injuries on both sides in that series, I think that the fundamentals kind of remain, and the Hawks haven't really looked that great against Cleveland either. So, you know, Korver's going to have to go nuts. for the Hawks. Mike Scott's going to have to go nuts. They're going to switch. They're going to go under on pick and rolls a lot. You know, Teague and Schroeder are going to have to hit some threes. That's the way for the Hawks.
What I want to mention one thing, just because I know I'm going to be fixated on it. The Schroeder-Dellavedova duels, when the second units are out there, are going to be some of the craziest stuff that we've seen in the playoffs from a decision-making perspective and just everything. I just feel like something crazy is going to happen.
All right, let's talk about Golden State and Portland today. We were at this game, and when we talked about the preview, I think I probably even gave the Warriors a little bit of short shrift, but the fact is that they just have so much size and length and force advantage at every position over the Blazers that it really, you know, other than the three, every Blazer on the floor was just way smaller and way, I think, you know, maybe Plumlee you could say is more athletic than Bogut, but Bogut is kind of better at being a center, you know, his strength and rebounding and rim protection. And, you know, that's kind of how it played out. And the biggest thing that was a huge disappointment to me, though, for Portland was I thought their defense was horrendous.
Absolutely horrendous. And it wasn't the same as Houston, where their transition D was really bad. It was more just half court. There are different ways that a defense can be shaky or bad. And what I had noticed this throughout the season with Portland is that when you make them defend, and we talked about this a little, this is what I was alluding to with Toronto, is when you make them defend for at least 18 seconds, usually they spring a leak somewhere. And this Warriors team isn't actually perfectly suited to cashing in on that leak, especially when Harrison Barnes isn't making shots. But it's just hard to sustain that when you have to, even without Stephen Curry, to beat the Warriors, you have to play such mistake-free basketball. And I just don't think they're capable of it for seven games. They'll win a couple. I think they'll win at least one. But to think of a path right now for them to win this series just feels really unlikely to me.
The defense on Klay Thompson was completely inadequate. And Klay hit some great shots, don't get me wrong. But he was hitting everything on catch and shoots. And I think with this Warriors team, number one, like CJ McCollum was on him most of the time. Every once in a while it was Crab. I think you got to go with, and Aminu is playing the four now, you know, because Myers Leonard is out, and I think that's their best alignment. But I think you got to just go with Aminu on Klay, say we're going to, and that's if you're not going to switch at all. Like, I mean, you got to do one of two things. You either got to put a great defender on Klay that's just going to stay with him, you know, Trevor Ariza, Avery Bradley style, not switch at all, or you're going to have your bigs be way more cognizant and have them switch out in kind of emergency situations on pin downs and now just say, all right, Klay, you're going to have to beat us one-on-one by putting the ball on the floor. And neither is a great option, but it's got to work better than this game because Klay can just shoot right over CJ McCollum. And then if he blows by you, this Blazers team has no one to protect the rim at all. Like Davis and Plumlee are just totally inadequate in that respect. And so I think that was a big factor too, that the Blazers just don't have anyone to protect the rim. And, you know, this is a great mid-range shooting team for the Warriors, and all of their guys are able to just shoot right over their competition who are matched up. So I don't think there are any great answers for Portland, frankly. I mean, I think they can do a little bit better job on Klay and just recognize that we are just not going to let this guy shoot, catch and shoot threes. I mean, he got 14 three-point attempts, and he made seven of them. Like, that's just too many attempts. Like, you got to take that away and make some of these other guys beat you. And then, but, you know, even on switches, like, Draymond was awesome in the post, too. Like, I think he scored three buckets. He got fouled four times. He had a few assists as well. Like, he was great in the post, mostly against smaller guys. So I don't think that there are any great answers defensively, and there are probably even less good answers for them offensively.
There was a point where I was talking with people when I was doing that at Reddit MA, and they were like, oh, maybe it was actually specifically about Mason Plumlee and the idea of maybe I was overvaluing rim protection. And I feel like I could just be like, watch this game. The Blazers were 14 of 31 in the restricted area, which is, you know, that's definitely worse than normal. And the stat that jumped off the page for me with that, and of course, small sample size, all that kind of stuff. But Andrew Bogut played 25 minutes. In those 25 minutes, Portland had an offensive rating of 69.9.
Yeah, really the only time they were able to get going was in the fourth quarter, which was pretty close to garbage time, and in the start of the second quarter when CJ McCollum was really hurting Maurice Spates in pick and roll. But ultimately, McCollum was 5 out of 17, Lillard was 8 out of 26, and that even took him getting really hot down the end. He also was 10 of 10 from the free throw line. But, you know, I think he had 18 in the fourth quarter, Lillard did, so he was shut down during the important portion of the game. And then Plumlee was 0 for 7, you know, one of which was just getting a dunk thrown back in his face by Bogut, who was fantastic. And then another tactic that they did that worked great against the Blazers starters was Bogut guarding Mo Harkless. Harkless was not really able to make him pay. He was 1 out of 5 on threes, and so they gave him the Tony Allen treatment. And then it was Draymond guarding Plumlee. Plumlee tried to post him up one time. That was hilariously awful. And then they had the option of switching when they wanted to on those pick and rolls to put Draymond on Dame. And then, you know, Dame's going to just have to shoot a tough shot over Draymond, you know, because you're not getting the switch. And Plumlee is not going to post up whoever you're switching on to. And even that is, you know, is going to be Klay, who is not, you know, a tiny little point guard. Klay was great as well, fighting over picks in this one. So it was really, they didn't even really have to go to Green at center, which takes the switching to another level, because Bogut was able to guard Harkless against the starters. And Harkless, he worries you, I think, shooting a corner three. I'm not as worried about him shooting an above the break three.
There were a couple of moments that I was really amazed by in this game, and that was, a lot of it was when Lillard and McCollum, sometimes they were driving not as much through a pick and roll, and they would have to get to, first they'd have to get to Draymond, and Draymond would usually stone them, and then maybe they do a pass something around, and Bogut was still there. Like, so you'd be sitting there, it was kind of like when there's another boss, like you're playing a video game, you're getting hit by the mid boss, and then you realize the big boss is still behind that, and you're like, oh crap, how am I ever going to get through this? And the other big takeaway, you mentioned that Draymond at center was not used that much. The primary Draymond at center lineup got, I believe, 6 minutes in this game, and they were, you know, the net rating was plus 20-something like it usually is. And what is incredible about the Warriors, and I think what people are going to appreciate as teams try to do this more often, is that most of the time when you go small, you're doing it with the understanding you are sacrificing more than a few things. Usually you're sacrificing rim protection, you're sacrificing a couple other things, because you gain the playmaking and everything else. You aren't going to beat the Warriors that way, because you aren't going to have a guy like Draymond Green playing center in that, where you get the rim protection, you get playmaking, you get all the stuff that Portland hopes they're getting from Mason Plumlee, except you're getting a way better defender. And so teams are going to try it, of course. They're going to try it. But against the Warriors, I think they're going to fail.
Yeah, the other thing that killed Portland was, I think it was 44% offensive rebounds for Golden State in the first half. You know, that's another thing I've talked before about Plumlee, despite his raw rebound numbers in that series against the Clippers, just as not really a good defensive rebounder. And then, you know, when you're all the rest of your guys are chasing everyone around the perimeter, and then not many of them are really great rebounders either, so they can be hurt on the offensive glass. That's something that when the Clippers tried it, they were able to get them, but they generally eschew the offensive glass, and Golden State doesn't necessarily do that as much, especially when they're able to get to the basket. The first quarter was ridiculous. It was 37-17, and I mean, Golden State should not be scoring that well without Steph against the Blazers, but, you know, just that size and the inability to guard Klay Thompson is what led to that.
It was a remarkable performance in a kind of a different way, but in a spiritual analog to the second half of Game 4 after Curry got hurt, where you're just sitting there the time being like, the other team should be playing a lot better. And in that game, you know, Houston didn't show the heart, and Portland clearly did in this one. But it is pretty impressive how good this team is, just how well coached they are and how much depth they have. But of course, that doesn't mean that they can beat a team as good as whoever they're going to face in the next round if they make it without Stephen Curry.
Couple other notes here from this one. Per Mike Richmond, the Blazers shot 5 out of 27 with their starters on the floor and had a net rating of -65.5. That is bad. The one way that CJ McCollum was able to be effective was in isolation, just driving to his right hand with a hesitation. He beat Sean Livingston on that a few times, and Synergy Sports tweeted out that when he goes to his right on those drives, he shoots 55% on the resulting shot. A lot of that, too, is he really likes the step back going to his right, so maybe just an individual defense. The Warriors, if he's isolating, might want to try and make him go left instead of to that righty hesitation.
Also just not playing Anderson Varejao.
Yeah, Varejao actually probably had his best game as a Warrior, because he actually did some good things in addition to the fact that he got roasted a lot on pick and roll defense. He had a couple of block shots, had a tip in, a jumper. and then got thrown out of the game before he could do any more damage. But I think it is. Kerr was asked after the game about why Azealia isn't playing. He said, "Nah, he's healthy. We just thought Anderson was the better matchup, and he did okay. I mean, he at least executed and didn't let anybody take a three on him in pick and roll defense. But then they were able to blow right by him. But fortunately, missed a few layups. At the end of the third quarter, Stott summoned Pat Connaughton off the bench. And he got the shot at the end of the third quarter and bricked it by a mile because, hey, guess what? He hasn't played in, real NBA action in probably, 50 games or something. That was a little weird that they brought him in.
That was when Henderson got ejected, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but I still...
Oh, yeah, I agree with you.
He was playing the whole time. Yeah, that was the...
And Noah Vonleh, 1 minute in the garbage minute.
Yeah. And I think, actually, you can get away with playing... I don't think that Vonleh or Chris Kamen is the answer. I mean, they're low on bigs, but you can get away with playing two bigs more against this particular Warriors lineup without Steph because you don't have... I mean, the reason you can't play big so much against the regular Warriors unit is because a Steph pick and roll, if you can't get out on the floor and move your feet, actually Vonleh's okay at that. Then you're going to be dead and Steph will just three you to death. So you have to get more mobile bigs. But I think trying to have someone else other than CJ guard Clay, maybe even start Crab over Harkless next time, although that hurts your lack of rebounding and lack of force, kind of even more than it already did, but at least it, and then CJ's got to guard Harrison Barnes, but that's a lot. I'd rather Barnes post up than Clay just be killing him the whole time.
One thing we should definitely mention also is that Stephen Curry was interviewed during the game by Lisa Salters, and his quote on whether he plays in game three, not game four, game three was, and I quote, "To me, they're pretty good."
Yeah, I don't see what way he has of knowing that, frankly, because he just began doing light shooting today. He said he has full range of motion back in his leg, but I think that's just kind of any athlete's going to be optimistic. I don't think he has any way of knowing exactly how it's going to respond and when it's really going to feel 100%. And certainly, if they continue to dominate like this in the series, and I think getting this game one was huge for them. Now I think they can feel really, really good about where they're at, and especially with it being such a blowout. So I think that's all the more reason for stuff to kind of hang out. I mean, Curry even said, hey, it might be possible that he could play in game two, and that might be a smokescreen because the preparation with and without Steph is just so different that I think they've always kind of tried to smokescreen that a little bit, but it's I don't see Steph playing before game four, I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I don't either, and if they're up, if they win the first two games at Oracle, I would feel it'd be hard for me to play him in game four even, unless he's, because you know the hard thing is that if you don't need him to win the series, you definitely know that you're going to need him in the next one, so why even chance it?
San Antonio and Oklahoma City, this was one of the ugliest beatdowns among two teams that theoretically were close to evenly matched in NBA history. I mean, it evoked the Memorial Day Massacre back in 1985, in which actually the Lakers ended up winning that series after giving up a $1.48 to the Celtics in the first game. But the first quarter, it was over after that. The Spurs put up 43 points on 24 possessions for a 179 offensive rating, 89% true shooting, and it would be 100 true shooting if you just made a two-pointer on every single possession. They had a 30% two-point block rate, and Oklahoma City only had 20 points on 23 possessions.
And Danny Green, he blocked a Durant three, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think he might have. I mean, that was one of the big interesting things strategically. We spent a bunch of time of Kawhi on Kevin Durant, and it turned out that it was just going to be Danny Green on Kevin Durant, and then they went with Kawhi on Russ, which worked great because Russ, I don't think you could post up Danny Green necessarily either, but he really can't post up Kawhi. And I think Kawhi has a little bit more length, so he can kind of go under on some screens too and just contest, make Russ shoot a tough J and still get a little bit of a contest on it, maybe more so than Green could. That worked great. I mean, I think it's important to remember, I'll ask you this question. How much of this game changes how you see this series going forward?
Not that much, because
we both had San Antonio in six, right?
Didn't you say you had in seven?
Did I
thought you did.
No, I'm pretty sure I said six.
Okay, listener can go back and dig it up when he said either way.
Yeah, and that listener could even be
me. Yeah, it could be. But so I think that the defensive dynamic was interesting actually. So when I had Kevin Pelton on Real GM Radio, he brought up that possibility. I'm like, oh, that's an interesting idea. And then a couple hours later, boom, that's what happens. And it makes some intuitive sense, even though I generally think Danny Green is better on ball than off ball, just because Kawhi can totally stone Russ. And in a way, he has more variance. You can it kind of parallels
yeah,
the idea.
Yeah, that's a great point.
The idea that Durant can get his, and he wasn't that efficient this game. But anyway, even if he has a good game, maybe not a great game, then you can do that. But Russ, you know, if you shut him down, there's so much. And the big structural thing, which we knew was going to be an issue, but it was a lot more at center stage, was the idea that Oklahoma City's third perimeter player was always going to be a problem. But in this game, that was just catastrophic for Oklahoma City.
Yeah, Tony Parker's hiding place, i.e. Andre Robertson, was awful. Just takes forever to get his three-point shot off, was not close on his three-pointers at all. And he's not even good enough defensively this year. I think he's actually taken a little bit of a step back in his individual defense this year. But he's not like, you know, he's not Tony Allen out there. You know, he's not Kawhi. He's not like, I mean, Kawhi killed him. He's not like so good that you're like, oh man, he's at least making up for it on defense. Like, I know that Thunder starting lineup was great during the regular season, and if you had to put a gun to my head, I'd probably say play Robertson over Deion Waiters. But yeah, I mean, that's that lineup obviously did not do well at all. I think there are a couple of things. The shooting at the rim for the Thunder was so bad in this one. It was 10 out of 25 at the rim during the first three quarters when both teams were trying, and Tim Duncan was a major problem for them. But nonetheless, they still missed probably five or six easy layups that I wouldn't have necessarily chalked up to like, oh, this is because of great rim protection. You know, KD especially missed a few in the beginning. And then for the Spurs, they just shot unbelievably. You know, I mean, I think they were 20 out of 29 from mid-range for the game, which, you know, that's just not going to repeat. They didn't really get to the rim that much. I think they only had like 15 shots at the rim or something like that. And then they're obviously on fire from three-point range as well. They're 8 of 12 in the first three quarters. So even if they give up the exact same shots again next game, the Spurs are not going to shoot that well. Even LaMarcus noted that he made a few shots that he wouldn't expect to make normally, like that lefty hook when he was just tripping, or like the three-pointer from the corner, though he did hit the threes last year. It's not what he's been doing this year. So it's not as bad as it looks right now for Oklahoma City, but Enes Kanter didn't do anything. Deion Waiters didn't do anything at all. He was Robertson didn't do anything. Singler didn't do anything. They went back to Cameron Payne over Randy Foy, which is probably the right decision because Foy was terrible in the first round, except that you just put Cam Payne on ice for 30 games while you were playing Foy at backup point guard after the trade deadline. So Payne has missed out on some really valuable defensive experience. And we haven't even talked about, too, which we really have to get into, just how bad the Thunder's defense was.
Their transition defense in particular was abysmal, like Rockets level abysmal.
That was bad. Getting over screens was terrible.
Oh yeah, their pick and roll defense, that's right.
The communication was terrible. The rim protection was terrible. You know, just in terms of getting over there, or Kanter had one play where he was in position and he actually like jumped backwards from Aldridge to just let him shoot a layup. Like, it was incredibly, incredibly bad. Anthony Slater, at Anthony V. Slater, you can find this piece at his Twitter bio from the Oklahoman, wrote a nice piece going over the film of just like why they were so bad. And, you know, I mean, it's been a big problem for Russell Westbrook for a while. It came to the fore really in that game two loss, and he just, you know, could not guard Tony Parker. Tony Parker had 12 assists, which he never has that many assists. Even going back to his heyday, he was more of a, you know, a 6'7" assist guy, even in his prime. And he was just setting up Aldridge left and right for mid-rangers. I think I wouldn't worry as much about Aldridge on his straight post-ups. You know, I think you're just going to have to live with that. Like, if you're doubling off of those, giving them open threes, like, you know, I think Serge Ibaka and Adams should be able to do a good enough job to limit the damage on those plays. I mean, what do you think about that? Should they be doubling on Aldridge?
No, not in those circumstances, no.
Yeah, I mean, if he gets real deep like anyone, yeah, but I think he can defend. And then they also had nobody to stop Kawhi, and Kawhi had 25 points on 15 shooting possessions, and LaMarcus, 38 points on 23 shooting possessions. Just those two guys alone had 65 points. No, I'm sorry, yeah, what did they have? They basically, I think, had outscored the Thunder within like 1 point by themselves through the first three quarters.
That's not good.
And then Danny Green was 5 out of 6 on threes. That's the other thing. If he's going to heat up, like, this series is over for sure. Like, if he's going to turn into 2014 NBA Finals Danny Green, or 2013 NBA Finals Danny Green, they're in deep trouble.
Yeah, I don't really have anything more to add. We'll have to see where it goes. I fully expect the Thunder to play better in Game 2. I also fully expect that better is not enough in Game 2.
Yeah, a couple more small notes on this. I think that Nick Collison is not going to add anything to this team for the Thunder. I mean, maybe you can say he can guard LaMarcus on occasion, but it would be great if they could go with KD at the four, but then just another one of their crappy wings has to play. You know, I mean, that's KD at the four is something that could really give this Spurs team problems, because who is going to guard him? And if you actually had a guy who is a decent wing who could even do anything off the dribble or make a three-pointer in addition to Durant, then you got to put Kawhi and Durant, and then your four-man is now guarding that guy, and you got big problems. But Oklahoma City hasn't played that way at all. They've gone all in on resources with having big guys. They're not going to play small with Durant at the four, and they don't have the personnel to do that. And so that also means now that you can't get Tim Duncan off the floor the way a team like the Warriors can. And if you're just going to drive into Tim Duncan over and over again, he is going to just block your shot or make you miss.
It's a challenge. We can even play the game during game two of how many wings, if we're excluding, you know, the best guy from each team, how many wings on the Spurs would you take over the next best wing on the Thunder? It's at least two.
Yeah. One other thing, too, that I think might help a little bit is Kevin Durant, whenever he sets a screen, just never makes contact, you know, and doesn't give the ball handler any kind of advantage. I think, you know, I understand that a lot of those plays are for him and he wants to get over to his shot. But I think if he actually sets the screen, especially if he's screening for Russ or someone who can get in the lane, which would basically be Russ on this team, that's it, and maybe get a switch or something by actually making contact instead of just like slipping immediately, because they're just getting no advantage at all.
Yeah, it's something that bothers me actually about fives in particular that try to, you know, do the nominal pick and pops. It's just that the space that you create by as long as the guy can actually do something with the separation, that actually gives you a better opportunity, because they're going to have to scramble, they're going to help, and the ball will often find its way back to you with a better look than before.
We'll see. I expect San Antonio to probably win this next one by like 15, and then game three will determine whether we have at least, you know, a nominal series or not. Because the history between these teams is that the tenor has often changed significantly once you get into the other team's city. You know, in both 2012 and 2014, the home team won the first four games of the series. And then they have only beaten each other, I think, once on each other's courts over the course of those 12 games. So, and now 13 with this one. Now, you can't necessarily extrapolate. These are different teams to some extent, but I think that we'll see maybe something similar here where, you know, the Spurs are going to win this next one pretty easily, and then Oklahoma City, you know, I mean, Oklahoma City damn well better play better than this, if they're going to lose the series, because if I'm Kevin Durant and you just get completely destroyed like this over and over in the series, you got to wonder, like, why you're going to stick around at that point and feel like you have a chance to win when you're just that far behind the team that's not even the best team in the league.
I decline to comment.
All right, that'll do it for today. If you want to give us an iTunes review or rating, that would be fantastic during these playoffs. We really appreciate that. That helps us to get some sponsors, keep us in the consciousness, maybe get some more listeners, or also just tell a friend, too, especially, you know, your NBA fans in your life, if they don't get a chance to watch the late games on the West Coast, you know, they can listen to our podcast in the morning. It's always up on the East Coast by the time the games are over. And also just follow me on Twitter, Nate Duncan NBA, and Danny is Danny LaRue. We will talk to you all next time.